And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with Linware Peak. We're just speaking with Adrian Stalder of Salad.io and Silicon Slopes Park City Chapter. And now we welcome Seth Fletcher. He's the chief features editor of Scientific American. It's a fascinating publication from which we draw many interviews on Cool Science Radio. Seth has also written extensively about electric cars in a book titled Bottled Lightning. Seth is back with a new book called Einstein's Shadow, A Black Hole, A Band of Astronomers, and The Quest to See the Unseeable. Seth spent 6 years following scientists who were on a quest to photograph a black hole, which is quite a feat considering no one's ever actually seen one, though many astronomers talk confidently about their existence. How do you take a picture of something from which no light can escape? Well, Seth is joining us now to talk about this journey and his new book. Seth, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Seth, I got to tell you that it's great to have a book that upfront defines all the acronyms and gives you all the cast of characters. It makes it a lot easier to follow along because it's not a complex story, but there's a lot of moving pieces, aren't there?
There are a lot of moving pieces. Yeah, I'm glad you like that. It was kind of a pain to put together, but I'm glad we did it because I just felt like there were so many names that people could use a little bit of a handhold.
Yeah, and I'm from the technology industry, and I'm used to acronyms, and I also had a big government presence with a couple of the companies, and so I'm used to all that stuff, but I tell you what, it's nice to have it defined up front, so it's great. One of the things I wanted to do before we talk about some of the characters and getting this done is the actual telescope itself. It's fascinating because EHT, which is Event Horizon Telescope, it's going to be the biggest telescope in the history of humanity. Can you talk about it a little bit?
Sure. Well, an interesting little wrinkle about the EHT as a telescope is that it's, in a way, not really a telescope. It's a virtual telescope. It is an array of radio observatories spread around the globe, and they work simultaneously using this technique called Very Long Baseline Interferometry, VLBI. So this is one of those acronyms. And basically, it's a way of mimicking an actual Earth-sized telescope without building a literal Earth-sized telescope. So they go out, astronomers go to all these places. They're in Hawaii, Chile, Mexico, Europe, the South Pole, and they observe the same thing simultaneously. They record all the data on hard drives, then they ship all those hard drives back to a supercomputer and combine them into a single master data set. And because of this magic of interferometry, that actually produces the results that you could get with a literal Earth-sized telescope. And that just happens to be what we think we need to see the shadow of the black hole at the center of the Milky Way, among other objects.
Well, telescope time is precious. It's difficult to schedule. There's so many competing projects and groups of people vying for the time and vying for the right weather. To be able to schedule multiple telescopes, I mean, you know, what type of person was Shep Dolman to put this whole thing together?
Really obsessive and insistent. It seems like, you know, I started following these guys in 2012. They had already been at it for many years, but they had just announced their full ambitions and called themselves the Event Horizon Telescope and kind of, you know, had this foundational kickoff meeting. And back then they were using three telescopes, one in Hawaii, one in Arizona, and one in California. And I spent a week with them in Hawaii on Mauna Kea, and it was so hard for them to get just the three telescopes lined up when the weather was good, that it seemed really hard to imagine them doing it with eight telescopes on different continents. But they did it, not to give away the ending. A lot of it is luck, but the way they do this is they carve out they get a span of 10 days on all these telescopes. And within those 10 days, they can use X number of nights. I think in the 2017 observation, it was 5 nights. And so then they send the astronomers to all these telescopes, and then each morning they look at the weather forecasts around the world, and then they decide in the afternoon, go or no go, do we use this night of observing? And if they do, then all of the telescopes work simultaneously. And then if the weather goes bad, then they're sort of out of luck. They've burned a night. So there's still a lot of sort of gambling at the last minute on the weather and on technical issues. You know, lots of technical issues happen along the way. So, you know, and that's on observations, that's sort of where the excitement comes in.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Seth Fletcher. He's the author of a new book called Einstein's Shadow, A Black Hole, A Band of Astronomers, and the Quest to See the Unseeable. So, Seth, you are a journalist and a writer. Your last book was called Bottled Lightning, all about super batteries and electric cars. And so you entered this new subject probably curious, but not knowing a lot about black holes. I think a lot of us lay people, we've heard of them. We don't really know what they are. We don't know how they formed, but astronomers themselves are not sure how black holes are formed. Can you talk about your early education to figure this whole thing out, which you sort of do in your, not your intro, but your author's note right in the beginning, which is so great.
I mean, so it was definitely intimidating, and I think the reason that I thought I could get my head around this stuff well enough to write this book is that I was just so interested in it. I found it so fascinating, much more than anything else I had written about for a while or read about. And so I thought, I can get obsessive about this for a while. And, you know, the interesting thing is that I came away, it took a long time to sort of wrap my head around the physics. The real breakthrough that I had was when I realized that nobody can really visualize four-dimensional space-time. It's just not possible. So that's why this seems so hard. And that I think that's why in the past, when I've read other books about general relativity, I sort of hit this wall of thinking like I'm not smart enough to get this or visualize this. But no human can visualize the warpage of four-dimensional space-time. You know, so we have mathematical shortcuts. And sort of once I realized, oh, okay, I'm not supposed to be able to picture exactly what's going on here. We all have to use shortcuts, and there's a big mystery here, and there's some element of this that might remain forever unknowable. And that made it sort of doable. Once I understood that the scientists themselves are working with shortcuts and tricks and heuristics and workarounds to study these things, and that they themselves have tons of questions about this, that's when it became manageable, I think.
Yeah, it's like when you know, it's knowing that there are so many things that you don't know. That's the true knowing. That was quite an accomplishment on your part. General relativity describes the universe on the largest scales, and quantum mechanics governs the subatomic world. And you talk about how these two theories crash together most violently in black holes, and yet black holes may kind of describe a theory of everything. And so can you talk about this conflict or this crashing together of these theories in black holes?
Sure. So, general relativity is Einstein's theory of gravity. It describes the universe on the largest scales, galaxies, planets, orbits. Quantum mechanics is the theory of the subatomic world. Those theories just describe very different worlds. The world of general relativity is classical, smooth and continuous and predictable. And the quantum world is kind of fuzzy and grainy and kind of fundamentally unpredictable in some ways. And a black hole, the physics that describes a black hole, you have to they meet. You know, GR and quantum mechanics meet. And Stephen Hawking, his big claim to fame was really showing how this happened and all of these paradoxes that it creates. And theorists have spent, you know, almost half a century trying to work their way out of some of these problems that Stephen Hawking uncovered. And they haven't really found a good solution. And meanwhile, lots of other physicists have spent time trying to find a deeper theory of nature, one that combines gravity and general relativity and quantum mechanics. The reason that it's so interesting to be able to look at the horizon of a black hole is that it's possible that things happen there that would allow us to sort of pull the threads on either of these theories. The thing is that, you know, quantum mechanics and general relativity are both, they've passed every test. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the reason why it's so hard to figure out how to combine them or how to go deeper, because it's hard to figure out what's wrong with them. But gravity has never been tested. General relativity has never been tested in the place where it gets as strong as it does at the edge of a black hole. So there's one possible avenue for progress. We could see maybe general relativity deviates somehow when you get to the edge of a black hole. And that would be a clue. That would tell us where to go looking for this deeper theory that unites these two. And there are lots of other different scenarios, but nobody really knows what they're going to see. So that's the hope.
And one of the questions that I have, I think I know the answer, but photons of light do not have any mass.
Right.
How are they affected by, well, it's not gravity, it's the mass of the black hole that affects the photon. Is that correct? I mean, this whole thing about so dense that light cannot be emitted, how does that happen?
Well, so this is where a real physicist would be better to answer this question. But basically, light gets redshifted kind of out of existence by a black hole. That is something that I'm not sure I'm going to be able to describe very well. But I think the thing to know about the reason gravity acts on light is because it curves space-time.
Right.
So for Einstein, gravity is the curvature of space-time. So it just determines the path that light, a photon, travels on. And near the edge of a black hole, space-time is so warped that it curves the paths that photons travel, and that's why you get these features that scientists have predicted, like there's supposed to be a shadow and a photon ring where photons are just trapped in a precisely circular orbit around the edge of the black hole.
The event horizon.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, I'll just mention this. I read a description of special relativity, and I figured, man, I need someone else to explain this to me. So then I read another description by somebody else in several pages, and I did this like four or five times. I still don't understand it, it amazes me that Einstein put all this together in the first place, and then after he published General Relativity, this guy Carl Schwarzschild, chapter 4 of your book. People are shooting at him. He's on the Russian front. He's an astrophysicist. But he has time to not only read Einstein's entire thing on relativity, but to actually look at the equations, do the math, and come up with a metric. I mean, tell us about this guy.
Carl Schwarzschild. Well, you know, I wish there was a really... I wish there was more written about him. I don't know a lot about his personality, but I know that he was a very esteemed German astronomer. He was the director of an astrophysical observatory, and he enlisted in the war, and he was at the Russian front, and just keeping up on progress in his field. And he managed to do something that even Einstein thought would be impossible, which is find an exact solution to his field equation. And an exact solution to Einstein's field equation is another equation. It's a metric, as you mentioned. That just basically is a way of measuring the shape of space-time in some place where it, you know, the shape, the curvature of space-time will be different there than in other places. The metric sort of helps you measure that. The consequence of this, which took people a really long time to appreciate, was that there's a point where this Schwarzschild metric kind of goes haywire, and it's sort of like the equivalent of divided by zero. You know, it just doesn't work. You can't divide one by zero. That's just undefined. It's a singularity. These Schwarzschild singularities, you know, for decades were thought of as just mathematical artifacts. And then in the 50s and 60s, people started to realize, no, we actually think these things might be in the sky, and they might explain things that we can't explain otherwise. But it took decades for people to come to grips with this thing that Carl Schwarzschild figured out, you know, in the trenches, World War I, which is amazing.
So, Seth, you also preface your book with a selected cast of characters. And they're all of these astrophysicists and astronomers, and there are dozens of them working, like you say, at, you know, 8 or 10 different telescopes all around the world, from Chile and the Atacama Desert to France to Hawaii to Spain, California, all over the place. And if... I mean, it seems like if they were to ask a singular question and want to prove one thing, and that is that a black hole could be photographed, then it would be simple. But I'm sure the dozens of various scientists were really trying to ask a variety of questions about black holes in general. And for you, what were the most profound of those questions? I mean, you've been talking a little bit more about it, but what really stood out for you?
Well, I mean, on one level, it's a technical challenge, and so I think for some of the astronomers, it's just a feat of ingenuity. You know, and that fascinated me a lot. Just this idea that people could, you know, sort of use the planet as a telescope in a way to see something that is really definitionally unseeable. I mean, they're trying to see its shadow. They're trying to see as close as possible to the nearest exit door from the universe. That's pretty crazy. In terms of the scientific questions, I was most drawn to the really deep questions related to the black hole information paradox, which is what Stephen Hawking is, one of the things Stephen Hawking is famous for. And the idea there is that a black hole seems to destroy information. The idea there is that black holes actually eventually will evaporate, in theory. But when they do, the stuff that comes out of them contains no traces of information about what went in. And you might say, okay, what's the problem? And some people have said, okay, well, what's the problem with that? That's just what black holes do. The problem with that is that the rules of quantum theory strictly forbid that. You cannot destroy information, because then you can't really understand the processes that led to something happening. And basically, it's a way of saying black holes kind of are this, they seem to be this sort of nihilistic force, you know, just showing that here scientists have spent centuries, you know, making progress in understanding the way the universe works, predicting the future from, you know, set conditions by finding equations, how things evolve over time. You know, in theory, you should be able to burn an encyclopedia and then reconstruct it from the ashes, if you know everything about every particle that went into it and everything that happened to each particle when it was burning, black holes seem to say, no, you can't do that. In fact, you know, as Stephen Hawking once said, black holes seem to suggest that maybe you can't even know if your memories are real. You can't connect the present to the past. And so there's this really deep, bizarre threat that black holes seem to pose to all science. You know, just the ability to know the universe. And that was what fascinated me the most. And that it took a while for me to get to that point in the research, and I could keep reading about it, you know, probably for the rest of my life and not read everything that has been written. So that just the fact that the black hole is just kind of out there taunting us in a way, that's kind of how I came to think of it, taunting all these scientists in all these different ways. For some people, it's saying, like, can you see me? I'm technically unseeable. For other people, it's saying, can you understand me? I seem to suggest that maybe the universe isn't knowable at all. And so there are all sorts of really weird, deep questions related to this that's why I was able to spend so much time studying it, researching it, and working on this book.
So we've been talking about a lot of complex topics here, but I want to just make the point, and we've got to let you go soon, but that what you're doing is you're kind of taking astrophysics and you're making it digestible, accessible. The idea is that you're making this sort of like an adventure story so that that lay people can begin to understand. I mean, maybe for some of us, we just disregard black holes because we don't understand them, whereas for you, it sparks your fascination and curiosity and makes you spend 6 years researching it. And that may be the difference between you and a lot of people. But I think if a lot of people are made a little bit more aware and have a cursory understanding of it, they'll start to delve into it further. And I think that's the great job that you do in writing this book, Einstein's Shadow. So Seth Fletcher, it's a pleasure talking to you. I wanted to ask you about your book. I know it was from 2011 about electric cars, bottled lightning, but do you think maybe you can come back on Cool Science Radio someday and talk about that?
Sure. I'd be happy to.